So we're doing this short little course, How Buddhism Helps. That's, you know, good for whether you're a beginner. It's also a good refresher. And so I've tried to put it together so that in 3 weeks it gives you a really good overview of the main, the, you know, the essence of the Buddhist path and how it applies in our day-to-day life. So we've got something to get started with. And then when you do more study or more teachings or meditations or everything, you can see where they fit in. You've already got a structure to hang it all from. So it's 3 weeks, and this week we're going to be mostly focusing on wisdom. I thought I'd start with a bang, start with the top bit, and then we'll get easier. So the basis of the course is this fantastic book, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism, which Delma might have showed you when you first came in. It's one of those free booklets. So at the very least, if you don't get the notes for the course, which are these ones with all the worksheets and the meditations and everything in it, at the very least get one of these books, because it's a lot, it's pretty much what I base the course on, the three principal aspects of the path. And so it's a teaching by Lama Yeshe, who's there in the photograph, and he summarized what Lama Tsongkhapa said. And so Lama Tsongkhapa got all of the Buddha's teachings and everything, and as Venerable Rabina says, put them together as a course, a course of how to become a Buddha, how to become free of suffering and become a Buddha. So in a really coherent start to finish kind of way, the ultimate course. And Lama Tsongkhapa, of course, was a not just a fantastic scholar, but he was also a practitioner too. So he walked the talk. He was a great yogi. He actually personified all of the teachings. So it wasn't just academic. So, you know, when we're looking at how Buddhism helps, it's not just for our current everyday problems, but it's really for the big picture. Often it's our current problems that get us here to a Buddhist center. That's kind of like the focus, but it's also in the context of our whole life and our community and the world, and not just for dealing with one problem now, but for the all of the problems and all the causes of the problem. So it's a really big picture context. So my aim for this course is to be like a bridge between the huge enormity of the Buddha's teachings and our day-to-day stress, time-poor life. And you just need like a little bridge just to kind of to get you over there and open the door, and then you go, wow, look at all of these amazing resources and what I can use. But it can be quite disconcerting sometimes, especially if you're new, where to get started, what do I do? There's so many books out there and there's so many different teachings and different types of meditations. You know, what do I start with? So this is a really good place to start. So, yes, useful if you're Buddhist or not Buddhist or even not religious at all, because it's going to be able to at least minimize the damage that we do to ourselves and others. Be able to make the most of the life that we have and really enjoy the things that we like doing, and how to develop a sense of, you know, care and altruism for others without burning out. So all of those things are necessary whether you're religious or not. So there are meditations to integrate the theory. There's a meditation to do throughout the week for each of the topics. And there are also some really simple worksheets that I've done. Just a few questions with just a couple of lines, like not whole paragraphs, but just a way to start that inner reflection and inner conversation. So it brings it home to what matters to us, makes it personal. Right, so there is a big theme here of reconnections. I'm really amazed. So I may as well tell you a little bit about me too. So I've been at Lung Retirement Centre for a long time because it was actually my mother who started this centre, and in her little house in Newmarket where you went, and I was still a schoolgirl. And so I kind of had a big a big deviant over falling off the wagon and then kind of came back to Buddhism again, very much on my own terms. I didn't want to just take on all of my, you know, received beliefs and all of that just because someone said so. I really wanted to figure out if it was going to mean something to me or not. My study was very, very sporadic until I actually came here to be the program coordinator. And then that's when I, you know, actually came back to some form of formal study and really trying to get my head around all of this. And so for the last couple of decades now, I've been putting together courses of, well, what kind of course would I have wanted to go to? was I desperate to go to? And then trying to put those together as like entry level courses and you know, ones that have the authentic Buddhist teachings but are in a contemporary kind of approach. So my whole background then, you know, there's a lot of stories that I can share with you, embarrassing moments that illustrate points and you know, from my own experience what I found, as well as from, you know, quotes from the teachings, and then where you can go for further research. So you'll be able to place it along that, whether, you know, it's just my opinion or whether it's actually what the Buddha said or the Buddhist texts say, and then a little bit about modern psychology and things thrown in too, because I like reading about all of, you know, neuroscience and all those things, but that's just like pop culture, like we do read about it, but there are some parallels that we can draw. And actually the course that's coming up after this one with Corey Jackson will go much more in depth into that, of the parallels between our modern society and Buddhist wisdom and where they correlate, where they actually match, which I just find so fascinating. So yes, I grew up a Buddhist and then studied all sorts of things and got right into reading Nietzsche and into postmodernism and all that, but I just kept on coming back to Buddhism as like the anchor that everything was around. So I only came with a very short plan, but many years later I'm still here, so far so good. Let's do just a short meditation just to you know, settle our motivation and make it a really good, strong one. So any form of meditation that we do, to get into a posture, it's just two main points. One is to have your spine fairly straight so that your posture is alert. And when the posture is fairly alert, then it's more likely our mind will stay alert. So it's a way of making it easy for us to become focused and concentrated. Just simply by straightening the spine. Feel a thread of light run from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head as if you're being pulled up by your crown. So feel the weight of your body suspended, your posture naturally straightening. And then once your spine is straight, the second point is to relax your body. So in particular, to let your shoulders drop and let go of all the tension that we hold in the neck and the shoulders. Just feel it release and roll down the neck, the shoulders, and off the tips of the shoulders. And just bring your focus to the gentle rising and falling of the breath. If any thoughts or feelings or anything else arises in the mind, just putting them aside, having your focus just simply anchored on the breath, allowing everything to become still, just like autumn leaves come to rest once the wind has stopped. And then to adjust our motivation, we can start with just some really simple questions like, do we yearn to make something of our life? Do we hope our life will get better, not worse? Do we have people or others that we care about or are responsible for their well-being? Do you wonder about the big meaning of life questions? What's it all for? What's it all about? And what can I do? So all of these questions often are floating around in our mind. So what we can do is really focus our motivation. That in this short course, we can really find out how we can help ourselves immediately now in our current situation, but also for the long-term benefit, putting it into the big picture of really taking the essence of this life. How we can help ourselves and also how we can help others. And without putting any limit to it. So thinking, may we continue with this momentum, this good heart, this determination, and may we continue with this really positive momentum from here all the way up to liberation, our own liberation, and then full enlightenment so we can perfectly help all others. So recognizing that's possible. So not limiting ourselves, but keeping that open as a possibility. And including expanding our good-heartedness and motivation out to include the benefit of everybody. So with this motivation, then gently bring your focus back to the room. And I haven't had a chance to read the online people, but it seems you've had a really nice chat already. So I'm glad there's a parallel universe going on there. So to set the scene, you know, how Buddhism helps, we've got to actually start with, well, what is Buddhism? So here's some more questions. What do you think? Is Buddhism a science? Hands up. Half a hand. A psychology, hands up. You're not putting your hand up though. I can't see both hands. A philosophy. Okay, that's got some more hands. A religion. A majority. Okay, I'm going to say it's different each time I ask this question. How many hands go up? So I threw this question in. Yes, all four, and or it depends. That's right. And actually, somebody asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama this in one of the public talks in Brisbane, you know, is what is Buddhism? Is it, you know, isn't it a philosophy? Is it really a religion? And he gave a really interesting answer. So the answer, the basis, the ground of Buddhism is a science and a mind science, so an inner science, a really profound understanding of what goes on in our mind, really sophisticated model, what the mind is, how we interact with the world, how we relate with the world, and how largely we make our own reality. So this inner science of the mind, very, very sophisticated model, way more sophisticated than any kind of, say, Western science of the mind. But on par with, like, when we look at our Western physical sciences, you know, once it's not just like chemistry and biology, it's all the way down to like physics and quantum physics, and that's really sophisticated. And that all in our external science, we use really sophisticated machinery to be able to look at the very, very small or the very, very large. And it's you know, can be highly complicated, doesn't necessarily come naturally. from the Buddhist point of view, looking at the science of the mind, it's an equally sophisticated model. But what the technology that we use is our mind, is actually our awareness and analysis and reasoning and observation, but it's all on the inner world. So for that, then there's very precise definitions and precise explanations of how things work. And the main thing about this, the basis of the science, is how we're all interdependent. What we do affects others. And it may not be immediately obvious, but it's there. And, of course, we kind of know this, don't we, intellectually, but yet we have pollution, we have climate change. So we might know it, but we forget it or we deny it. So this kind of interrelatedness with the world down to a very, very fine level of how everything that we see or think about comes with our own, you know, emotional baggage and our own view, and then that actually, in a way, brings our own world into existence. So on this level, on the mind science point of view, there is a dovetailing of parallel with quantum physics and the Buddhist understanding of the world and how the world exists, that in that field of probability. So there's a lot of meeting and parallel there. And there's also, of course, a lot of meeting and parallel when it comes to things like the environment, cause and effect. And the other thing about it being a basis as a science is that when, you know, people don't really say, oh, do you believe in science, or do you believe in Newton, or do you believe in Einstein? It's like, it's not, if you're in America, you might ask that question, do you believe in science? But thank goodness we're not. You know, at least why do we believe in science? Like, is it a belief even? What do you reckon? You went, it's whatever you want it to be. Did we study it at school? Some could see it as a belief if you didn't understand how it worked or if you hadn't studied it. And then, you know, it's like saying, do you believe in gravity? So I really like that one, because gravity kind of works whether we believe in it or not. Some little kiddies, well, they don't believe in gravity. They think they can fly. So. But there comes a time with science that it's a lot more than just belief. And so in a way with Buddhism, there's not, we don't come at it through this sense of belief. We come at it more through a sense of understanding, like we do with science, through this real confidence that comes from understanding. So that's the basis. And then out of that comes an ethical system. And so, because we understand that we're interdependent and related, and what we do has an effect, then naturally then how we act matters. And so then the ethical system that comes out of that, it's not like a top-down list of morals, do this and don't do that. It's just a natural thing of recognizing consequences and how we don't want to suffer and other people equally don't want to suffer, and how what we do has an effect. So this is really good, because then you can see the utmost need for compassion, whereas in our culture, compassion is actually an added extra. It's optional. First is the economy, and then if you've got some spare space, then compassion. But, you know, when it comes down to it, what's going to come first? I mean, actually, to be said, you know, when COVID hit, compassion did come first over the economy, with, you know, all of the financial help and things. So that was a big change in the approach, wasn't it? But actually, from this, if we have an ethical system that's based on science, then naturally the result is we have to look after everybody. So it's a natural result of recognizing interdependence. And So far, you don't even have anything religious. Out of that then comes all of the ritual, the meditations, the practices, the art, all of the ritual expression, using the music and the chanting, using all of our senses as human beings to connect with that meaning. because we're not just going to have a list of ethical points or just study science. We're actually here in the world, and you know, and there's beauty and there's pain and there's all sorts of things. So how do we use this whole human experience on the path and embody it all? So all of the ritual is an expression of the ethics and the science. So it all has a meaning, whether the meaning is immediately apparent or not, but it's in there. So all of the tankas and all of the, everything on the altar, it all has really deep meaning there that as you practice, then you learn more about it and it becomes apparent, it becomes very rich. If you don't know about that and you just come in, you just think, oh, everyone's just chanting and that's nice, but it kind of feels a bit embarrassing. Fair enough if you're not aware that there's this underpinning to it. And a lot of people are a bit uncomfortable with ritual, and rightly so, because if you're coming at it from a sense of superstition, it's not going to sit well, you know, and that's okay. It's actually better to come at it to understand what's behind it all. So then His Holiness said, you know, you don't actually even have to become a Buddhist. You just use Buddhism to become a better what you already are, and take quite a few years to try it on and really find out about it, and then make your mind up later, you know, which is a really nice pragmatic approach, I thought. So that's the Buddhism side of things. Now, how does Buddhism help us? So the whole enormity of the Buddha's teachings, where to start? So Lama Tsongkhapa showed how we can start with what are called these three principal aspects of the path. And so the first aspect is what's called renunciation. And this is actually the modern term for this is self-care. So it's actually the how to look after oneself. And what it is developing a wish to be free of this cycle, the up and down cycle of, you know, gain and loss and fear and craving and all of those things. Some days are good and then they crash down again and everything's going fine and then it's suddenly everything goes wrong. So this cycle of dissatisfaction and suffering. So it's a wish to become free of the cycle. And that's not necessarily something we naturally have. We have a wish to be free of suffering, but we don't necessarily have a wish to be free of the causes of suffering. And so it doesn't matter how big our wish to be free of suffering is, we've actually got to do a little bit more than that, than rather just going, no. So how to develop renunciation. And so how it is represented is as a lotus, because a lotus grows in all the mud and the muck and the disgusting, you know, stuff you don't want to wiggle your toes in, and yet it comes out and it's pristine clear. There's no dirt, actually doesn't stick to the lotus petal. It's the way, in fact, NASA was looking at how to make spacesuits in the same way that the lotus petals are made, because they repel dirt. So renunciation is like, it shows that our mind is by nature pure, so it can emerge from all the muck of our up and down existence. It can emerge unbroken, unstained. It's really lovely, unsullied. So recognizing how our mind is by nature pure, and then we can do something about it. So then bodhicitta is the next one, the compassion, like the cooling rays of the moon, and it's unbiased compassion. And it's not just empathy or feeling badly for others, but compassion has this sense of taking responsibility of like, I've got to do something. I can't just sit and watch this. What can I do? So it galvanizes us into action. So this is really how to help others. And great compassion or bodhicitta is helping all others. So, you know, our current world events at the moment, great compassion would be thinking, how can I help the Ukrainians? How can I help the army? How can I help Putin's soldiers, how can I help the Russians? How can I help everyone in Europe? How can I help everybody? It's no favoritism. Like, great compassion takes the concern for everyone. And it takes that feeling of empathy or compassion and turns it into an activity. So the moon, and then the other one, correct view or an understanding of reality. So the moon for bodhicitta is often depicted as like when the Buddhas or the bodhisattvas are on a moon disc, that represents bodhicitta when they sit on a moon cushion. And then sometimes, like with the visualization of the Buddha sits on a moon cushion and a sun cushion. So then the sun represents wisdom. And so that's like the rays of the sun eliminate darkness. So the darkness actually disappears, doesn't go somewhere else, it disappears. So our wisdom can illuminate the darkness within our mind. And so, in fact, the correct view, the understanding the nature of reality, this is what supports the other two. So in Buddhism, wisdom supports compassion and all the practices. Wisdom's the underpinning thing. This real understanding of reality, how things exist, and in particular, interdependence. So what we're going to have a look at today is the wisdom part. The wisdom understanding reality. So it's a very particular kind of wisdom. And there is a way to start developing this wisdom. And I've got a couple of examples that are going to be really simple that then we can use on other things. And we've got a little meditation and then a hypothetical of how to figure out how old we are. Because you might think you know now, but I can guarantee you by the end of the class, you will not know how old you are. Which is a good thing. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama actually said, you know, we're like at the center of all of our problems. So we've got to start with ourselves. We've got to start by looking within rather than looking just theoretically at other things, which can be easy, but it doesn't actually help us. So how to actually discover what is the root cause of all of our suffering, all of our problems, all of our confusions. And in a colloquial way, we can think of it as a confusion about our identity, who we are. And what happens is we make a mistake. And so what we do is we think there's a real me. There's a real concrete me right here, usually here. Lama Zopa Rinpoche often says, points to somewhere in the middle of your chest. Sometimes it's in your stomach, you know, when you get dread and you go, whoa, and you sink into your stomach, but mostly it's somewhere in here. We think this is me. And actually what we think is me is a complete mistake. And because it's mistaken, because we have this kind of innate confusion about who we are, then everything else comes from that. So all of the hostility that we feel towards others comes because, you know, when others disagree with us or harm us, harm our pride or harm those that we, you know, belong to us, anything like that, then hostility arises. Or when, you know, the desire arises, when we have this continuous feeling of dissatisfaction, of wanting more, of craving. And then anything that's pleasant or enhances our pride or our self-view, then we want more of it, more and more and more and more. So how come this cycle continues is because what we're feeding doesn't actually exist that way, so it's never satisfied. So even though we think there's a real me, no one in the history of the world has ever actually discovered this real me. There's been a lot of books written about it. There's been a lot of, I really want people to know the real me, but actually when we go looking for it, no one's actually discovered a real me that's like that independent, some kind of essence of Miffy or essence of Lana, you know, what is it? When you go looking for it, it cannot be found. And this is actually a good thing. This is not something to freak out about, but this is like our ticket out of samsara. Because if we actually want to stop suffering, we've got to stop this mistaken view of who we are and actually get a correct view of it, because then all of the suffering that comes from that will actually stop. So Lama Yeshe talks a lot about, where's my book, confusion about our nature, who we are, how we are, causes the three major disturbances of our personal world: confusion, hostility, and craving. So if we want to stop confusion, hostility, and craving, we've got to actually tackle the root cause, which isn't making everybody that we don't like go away, trying to get all the things that we want, you know, trying to sort things out. We just cut to the chase. From the Buddhist point of view, having renunciation of cyclic existence or having loving kindness, bodhicitta, compassion, these alone are not enough to cut the root of the ego or the root of the dualistic mind. By meditating on and practicing loving kindness and bodhicitta, you can eliminate gross attachment and feelings of craving. But the root of craving, desire, and attachment are ego and the dualistic mind. Therefore, without understanding shunyata or non-duality, it's not possible to cut the root of human problems. It's like this example. If you have some boiling water and put cold water or ice into it, the boiling water calms down, but you haven't totally extinguished the water's potential to boil. So that's what this wisdom does. It's the one that actually just takes the pot off the stove and stops the water boiling. Whereas the other ones are trying to be kind and patient and all of those things. That's like putting ice into the water. It stops the disturbances, but it doesn't deal with the root. And that's why we end up burning out after a while, because we haven't been actually looking at what's causing the problem. Of course, this is the deepest questions. And we're just going to do it in like one night. How do things exist? So I was trying to figure out, oh my gosh, this is asking a lot, isn't it? Doing it in like 20 minutes. So how do things exist? I've got a couple of examples that we can use. So let's just get the theory part together. All relative phenomena, how things exist, interdependently, not in a vacuum. So we know this to do with physics, biology, genealogy, everything in our Western world. We know this cause and effect. But it goes much, much, much deeper than that. We know our relationships, our job, our families, they all exist in a context, don't they? Our family history exists in a context. So that's kind of like the conventional nature of things. So because things exist interdependently, that means that ultimately all things are empty of existing in an independent way, or they're empty of existing in an unchanging way. So those two, they're like two sides of the coin. One way is saying we're all interdependent. The other is saying, therefore, we're empty of being independent. One's looking at the actual relationship and one's looking at the empty nature. Two sides of the coin. And of course, the easiest one to get to is the interdependence one. And then the conclusion that we come to is then, therefore, the empty nature. We're empty of being independent, empty of being unchanging. What this means for us is that the appearances, how things appear, isn't the reality. And this is something we forget all the time, to the extent that we judge people by how they look or how they speak or how they act on that one day that we first met them. You know, we think they've always been like that. And I know in my mind, when I first meet someone, I think that they've been, you know, you've been the age that you are now forever. Because then when I see like a photo of someone where they're a kid, I'm really shocked. It's like, oh, look at you. You know, so there is this thought of, you just have been like this since the beginning of the universe. Like, I know, intellectually, no. But in appearances, we just believe the appearances so easily. So let's have a look at the, what are the three levels of dependent arising. And so I thought I'd give you a really easy example and then a little story. So how do things exist is on three different levels, from the most kind of obvious to the most subtle. So the one, so if we're looking here at the leaf, causes and conditions. So when we see a leaf, again, we just think, oh, it's been a leaf like that forever and always will be. We believe that appearance. But actually, how did that leaf even get there? So there's a whole backstory, isn't there? It came from a tree, the tree came from a seed and it grew and all of these things. You can even take it further and think the whole development of biology, ecology, you know, back to the beginning of the world and the first amoebas and oxygen on the planet and the whole thing. The whole story is in there, in that one leaf. So if you're really good at gardening, you might think of that when you look at a leaf, but I just go, oh, yeah, it's a leaf. So causes and conditions. The leaf came from other things. It depends on other things, and it's always changing. So when we think about that, it's obvious, but we don't often remember that. But what's nice about this example with leaves and flowers is that when someone gives us, say, a bunch of flowers, you know, when they wilt, we don't just go, oh, no, what happened? Do we? We just go, oh, yeah, chuck them out. It's no problem, is it? Because we're ready for it. We're ready for the change. So with leaves and with flowers, we can handle the change. But with other things, are we ready for it? No. So it's really good to have a simple example to start with. Okay, then the middle one, the parts which compose them. So if we look deeper into that leaf, it's not a unitary, unified one thing, is it? It's made up of all these different parts, all the various cells, all the things that are happening with the cells and the photosynthesis. And so the further, the more you get into those parts, the more they've got parts as well, till you get to the most subtle one, which is here, where at the end of the picture, like the atom. So we know atoms don't actually look like that. They're not perfectly symmetrical little diagrams with a little red and a blue and a green bauble there. I mean, that's nice, isn't it? But I'd be pretty astounded if that's what they actually look like. So that's like an imputation. That's a diagram to explain a process. So actually, this most subtle level, we've got the causes and conditions, we've got the parts which compose that thing, and then on the most subtle level, imputation or name, a diagram, an idea, a probability, the mind that conceives of something and gives it a name. All of those levels is how things exist at present. But when we're not aware of it, and in fact what we grasp at is the seeming permanence of the reality of the thing. And then that grasping at permanence, for instance, is what gives us the pain. So if we were grasping at permanence of the bunch of flowers and then it wilted, we'd be devastated. Oh, no. So it's not that the flowers wilt that causes the problem, it's the grasping at it that causes us the pain. That's the direct cause of the pain. And, you know, with the leaves, we have the causes and conditions we can think about. We know what garden it came from, for instance, or something like that. We can think, oh, yeah, it's all that, the process of the cells. Further down onto the quantum field, it all happens. It's all existing simultaneously. But we really just have to bring our focus to it to remember. So here's the story. So it was an Australian story. I think it was an ABC article. And they had outback teachers in Australia. And so one of the teachers, you know, said to the class, everyone sit down, let's draw a kangaroo. And so, you know, there's a photo of a kangaroo. We kind of know what a kangaroo looks like. And what most of the kids drew was something like this. to various degrees of accuracy or not. But, you know, we'd, if someone said, well, what's that? We know what it is. Anyway, except for one kid who drew this. And the teacher's like, oh, no, sorry, darling, I asked you to draw me a kangaroo. And he's like, I did. And she, no, you didn't. So she drew this little cartoon of a kangaroo. He said, this is a kangaroo. Draw this one. He's like, I did. So what do you reckon's happened here? Yes, yeah, an Aboriginal kid. It's, yes, so what... What the kid actually said was, oh, you want me to draw what a kangaroo looks like. Big difference to actually drawing a kangaroo. So what he drew was, you know, the whole life story of a kangaroo, the kangaroo's environment, the whole where the kangaroo came from, the places where the kangaroo lives, the life cycle of the kangaroo, what the kangaroo eats, whose totem the kangaroo is, the whole thing, how it's there in the land. That's what a kangaroo is. It's not just one animal, is it? It's a whole interdependent story. And so how incredibly astute to say, oh, you want me to draw what a kangaroo looks like. yeah, that's right. You should, that's right. So then, you know, we've got this little happy medium here, the X-ray style of drawing, where you get what a kangaroo looks like, as well as a story, the whole interdependent, dependent arising of a kangaroo in there, a little bit easier to grasp. So I really like that. I find that incredibly helpful to just penetrate below. And don't we get into trouble if we just take things on appearances? And we so often do, because even, I mean, that's how come we get so much spin in politics, because we have a tendency to believe appearances. So you just need to be presented with the appearances, even if they make no sense, and it'll have an effect on us, because we grasp at appearances, it must be true. So in a way, this is a way that we've got to re-educate ourselves to start looking below. And the way that we do that is by trying to identify those three levels of how things exist interdependently, causes and conditions, sorry, then the parts, all the different parts that make it up. And of course, once you go into those parts, then you can go into the parts of those parts and into the parts of those, and then you get down to the quantum field and by name and imputation on a valid base. That's actually how the things exist. So then you get the whole interdependent nature. And the conclusion is, therefore, there's no independent kangaroo, there's no independent leaf, there's no independent me in the same way. So if we can do that, you know, one way, if we grasp at this real me as being true, this is the real me, then all the suffering comes from that. All the feelings of disappointed, being frightened, being unable to change or frightened of change, really rigid. All the fundamentalist views come from that, and all the tunnel vision physically, emotionally. And on the other hand, if we remember this interdependence, how even who we are is a dependent arising, we relax. There's nothing to defend anymore. We can adapt to a situation because we're just ready for change. Instead of going, no, it's of course. There's not the fear there. So then we're resilient. When things do change, we're naturally resilient. So resilience, you know, that's something we all need, clearly, isn't it? But it's not something that you get. It's a result of something. And of course, then we're more naturally confident, realistic, energetic, naturally happy, naturally content. The question, who am I really? What I think is we've got to not mix up the ultimate me and the conventional me. And so everything that I've felt is the real me is actually the conventional me. It's all the reaction to circumstances, to how I've been brought up, to my age, to how much sugar I've had today, all of those things combined together, and then I feel this is the real me. And that's the mistake. We think that that just very fleeting feeling of who I am is the real thing. So how we can start applying this is by thinking, well, how we feel is not the way that we are. And of course, a conventional dependently arising self does exist. No problem there, but it's not the real me. So that's getting those two things mixed up. The ultimate me does not exist in that way at all. So Lama Yeshe, here's this wonderful quote from Lama Yeshe. How do you interpret yourself? If we truly wish to achieve the satisfaction of complete fulfillment, we must find a way to break free from the tyranny of ordinary appearances and conceptions. I love that. It's a tyranny. Although we all have a fundamentally pure nature, it's not easy to get in touch with it. We need to quiet all distractions and loosen the hold our ordinary appearances and conceptions have on us. We need to create space so our essentially pure nature can function uninterruptedly. So it's very profound of how important it is to get this right, how we interpret ourselves. So it affects everything. So the tyranny of ordinary appearances, I mean, all you have to do is look at the news and we believe what we see. And even if the news is accurate, what we're getting, it's not that whole story. It's like not the whole story of the kangaroo, is it? Each of those people on the news has a whole amazingly complicated story in their life, and all the balance can change at any time. So there's a couple of shows on TV, you know, like Who Do You Think You Are? You know, and how it changes everything, doesn't it? You find you aren't who you thought you are at all. So it's like that with everybody. And the grasping to who we think we are means that we constantly have to feed that need. We constantly have to have others acknowledge it, and we can't bear it if people don't acknowledge who we are, and we get really defensive. So all of the emotional turmoil comes from that. So we're going to do a little meditation, but before we do, questions, comments about the most tricky topic of all? Anything at all that you're wondering about? So we have the theory, and I tell you what, the theory is like a lifesaver that you hold onto. It's like a safety vessel, life raft. In the tossing and turning, you just go, oh, yeah, that's right. Those three levels of dependent arising, hold on to that. And now let's do this contemplation. So just, again, settling your posture and bringing your focus inward. So you don't necessarily have to close your eyes, but just kind of withdrawing your senses or bringing your focus within. And we're going to investigate, how do we interpret ourselves right now? Lama Yeshe's question, how at this moment do you interpret yourself? So we can ask just a couple of questions. Who am I? So if someone asked you, who are you? What do you say? Or someone asked you, what are you? So your first answers might be actually what you do, but who are you? Those answers might be to do with gender or age or your job. So who are you? So when we try and answer this question, if some of the answer was to do with our gender, whether we're a man or a woman or somewhere on the spectrum, we might think, oh, that's who I am. But if we took gender out of the equation, or we just imagined, you know, what would our life be if we're a woman now? What would have happened if we had have had exactly the same life but have been born a bloke? How would things have turned out? Would they have been different? Or if you're a guy, can you imagine going through your life but being treated as a girl? So right there we can see that so much of who we are depends on our gender. It's circumstantial. And then we can think about our age. So how old are we? And then how old do we feel? Have we ever just felt like a little kid again? We might look at others and think, oh, old person, and then realize, oh my gosh, they're younger than me. Who we are might also be dependent on our race or our culture. If we're a refugee from another country, are we, you know, Serbian and Croatian, or are we Australian? When we're in Australia, people think we're Serbian or Croatian. When we're over in Serbia, they think we're Australian. How much of our identity is tied up with our family life, whether we identify as a parent or as a daughter or a son. Can we separate our identity from our family? What about our occupation or career? If we lose our job, do we also lose our sense of worth? And what about our looks? So if you're quite tall, can you imagine going through life, everything the same except being short? Or if you're quite short or petite, can you imagine how your life would be if you had been a 6-foot giant? What about if you're born with supermodel looks? How would people have treated you? Or born with different coloured skin? Would the way people treat you be different? So who are you? How do you interpret yourself right now? Which elements are you focusing on? Which ones could you choose to focus on to bring out your best qualities? And if you take away gender and age and occupation, who are you? And so then with this understanding that things do not exist in the way that they first appear, and we ourselves do not exist in the way that we appear. And gently bringing your focus back to the room. And let's see how you went with the contemplation. So did your idea of who you are change in the meditation? Yes. So who are you if you're not those? And is that it? That's the question, isn't it? Because if we think, oh, I am, say, for instance, a daughter or a mother, then when that situation changes, then what? Like when the parents die, now what? Or when the kids leave home, now what? Yeah, so, but it's thinking if that's what you are, then, you know, then things change, then we grasp after them. And, you know, that's why people have like a midlife crisis, because we just think we are youth. We don't even think it intellectually. We just assume we're youth. And then that changes. And we have a midlife crisis because everything that we thought we were is gone. Or we lose our job, and then we lose our status, and then the, you know, everybody responding to us in a way that kind of bolsters us up. Now who am I? So if you didn't get to see your family at all, then who are you? Because that's the thing, isn't it? So when people are separated from their family, then there's incredible pain because so much of who we are is associated with that. So what else? What else came with the meditation, the contemplation? I mean, I can relate to that. So whether we call it a soul, I mean, that's kind of in our Christian kind of heritage that we say, I'm just a soul wanting to connect with others. Or from a Buddhist point of view, you think, I'm a mind, an awareness, wishing for connection. But when we think who's the real me, that's not who we think, is it? Who the real me is, it's like, you know, it's Miffy who's a custom designer and la 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 and all of these things, these changeable things, mother, a daughter, a career, a this and a that. So we think all of those changeable things are the real me, and yet bare awareness, connectivity with everybody, that's actually the real me. But do we ever relate to that? So that's getting there, isn't it? That's much closer to the truth. Being part of everything and nothing at all is much closer to the truth than what we normally day by day think of it as me. And when we get offended or when we get betrayed or all of those things, we're not thinking like this in these big, wonderful, poetic terms of, you know, who I am is actually equally just like everybody else. Yeah. We're going, no, how very dare they, me and them. So that Lama Yeshe talking about the dualistic mind that separates us off from others. So the moment we do that, we have that dualistic mind, me and other, then all the fear comes in, all the craving and disconnectedness comes in, the whole catastrophe eventuates. So the thing is to start looking at all of those things that we grasp onto as being us, our identity. They're all changeable. They're all due to causes and conditions, and those causes and conditions will change. They're due to their parts, all the things that make them up, and they're due to the way we look at them. In particular, how we label them and if we label them as good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, and that's what makes them. And yet we just think, oh, it's obvious. So there's big discrepancy there. So the question, things do not exist in the way they first appear. This is the bumper sticker for today's class. Things do not exist in the way they first appear to us. So we have this kind of question in our mind. How things first appear, it's not the whole story. And that helps us psychologically, emotionally relax, and then the wisdom can come. So there's in the notes, there is this meditation to do throughout the week to get familiar with this, to just kind of loosen that rigid view. So what it means is it changes our whole mindset that when things do change, we can go with it without freaking out and actually respond in the best way that we can. So there's another example. Okay, here's the easy example. How old are we? How old are you? So even when someone says, oh, how old are you? Apart from like me drawing blank and having to count up on my fingers, which I'm really bad at numbers and never get it right anyway. If you ask, when are you born? We think we know how old we are and we think it's an inherent truth, but actually it's just a placeholder. It's just a convention, because when we actually start measuring how old are we, when do we start by counting how old we are anyway? It's like when we're born, isn't it? So even that, from my point of view, it's incorrect, because that just, if you're just starting when you're born, does that mean you're minus when you're in the womb? So actually, you're 9 months old when you're born, and yet 1 year later you have your first birthday. Actually, that's 1 year and 9 months. Already it's completely wrong and no one said anything about it. I mean, doesn't that strike you as strange? So the Tibetans apparently, when you come out of the womb, you're one. That's how they do it. They count that. So then after a year, that's you're two, because they count being in the womb as you know, positive time, not minus. So it kind of makes sense. So then, even then, like if we wanted to tell exactly, can you tell from the moment of conception, is it? You know, like from when it's just one cell or two cells or four cells, whereabouts do you then draw, okay, from just cells to actually a being? So this is like a perennial question in our Western society, and there's a whole range of answers to that. And even if you go, oh, okay, it's from the moment of fertilization, actually, when you look at, say, test tube babies, for instance, those eggs are fertilized, but there's no consciousness in there yet, because there's no karmic connection with the parents. So whichever kind of answer you come down to, you can't say definitively this is it. So when were you born? To figure out how old you are already, yeah, you can get a general idea within 9 months of how old you are. That's as good as it gets. Okie dokie. So what about then? Well, what are we measuring? So one way when we go how old we are is that a year isn't the same as we go through, because a year is a ratio. So can anyone remember being 4 years old or 4 3/4 and about to turn 5, and how it was a big deal, like you're almost in the biggies? Anyone remember that? No? I can remember being 4 3/4 and someone asking, oh, how old is she, to my parents, and they're saying, oh, she's 5. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm 5 next week and I can't wait. I'm 4 3/4. But so when you're 5, 1 year is 1/5 of your life. It's enormous. You know, it's gone on forever. When you're 55, 1 year is 1/55th of your life. And that's why it's gone in a flash. And now, oh my God, I'm actually 56. Whoops. So a year isn't an inherent thing. A year is how we experience it, and a year is a ratio of our life. But wait, there's more. So then we've got, how old do you feel? How old do you feel? Just day to day, how old do you feel? Ageless. All right. Oh, that is way out there in the stratosphere. How old do you feel? Yeah. Yeah. How old do you feel? 21. How old do you feel? Like a teenager? Yeah. So someone asked Eddie, like he's in his 60s, and he said, oh, I feel 17. and then after a while, I think he started saying, oh, I actually feel 22 now. So clearly how old we feel and how old our body is, there's a discrepancy right there. And then sometimes, like in class, people say, oh, I'm too old for that now. And then I find out they're younger than me, and I'm like, what? You know, I always think everybody is older than me, just you know, and clearly, no. And probably little old ladies feel like that too. They put, oh, you oldies. And it's like, but you're on a walking frame. So how we feel. But then when we're really tired, like if you're recovering from COVID, for instance, and you're quite young, you may feel much older. You just might just go, oh, look, I just, you know, feel like at death's door. I feel like 100-year-old. And that's generally how you feel. What about then if you're, you know how they say about people, you've got, say, a mental age of 12. You know, they have a caveat, so-and-so, they've got a mental age of 12. So that matters, doesn't it? Because if they're out and about driving a car or, you know, trying to rent a house or whatever, and we expect them to get it together, come on, hurry up. It's not fair. So then people say, oh, you know, they're 30, but they have a mental age of a 12-year-old. So then we adjust. So what are they? Are they 12 or are they 30? It's tricky, isn't it? So even then, how old someone is not how old someone is. And if we force it and we go, well, I don't care, they're 30, they should know better, that's mean. So we have that. And then we have you heard of that disease that the little kitties have called progeria? It's on those medical shows. So there is a really debilitating disease where the cells in your body age much, much, much faster. And so you have like little kids that are like 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and they have a physical body of like a 70, 80-year-old. And they've lost their hair, they've got arthritis, they have a croaky voice, like all of this. And things are slowing down, like they have a physical body of an 80-year-old. I kid you not, on a cellular level. And yet they're all chirpy and young, like a 10-year-old. It just breaks your heart. So now, how old are they? It's so full on, isn't it? And, I mean, physiologically it has an effect on you, of course, and yet the energy of youth is still there, despite the fact that you're dog tired and you've got achy bones and, you know, you can break your hip really easily and all of these, you get cold and, yes, so measuring, okay. Then, of course, it depends what calendar you're on. So are we going with the 12-month calendar? Are we going with a 10-month calendar? Or are you a lunar calendar, 13 months? Okay, enough about measuring. Okay, what are we measuring? So I'm not sure about the details about this, but if we say, okay, I'm 30 years old, which bit of me is 30 years old? Because actually, like, how old is your skin? How old, you know, your lungs might be 7 years old. Like, how often do they replenish? When you give up smoking, they say it's about 7 years before all the cells replace themselves. So your lungs might only be 7 years old. And, you know, your stomach might be X amount of years old, a different age. If you've had a heart transplant and that person was a different age from you, now are you two different ages? Or is one bit of you one age and the other bit of you another age? So what? And then the kicker What about your hair and nails? They're dead. So how old are you? And are you even alive? I mean, what? All of the cells of your skin, you know, constantly. And not only that, of course, then there's all the various microbes within our body that aren't even us, that mean that we can digest, that mean that we don't suffocate on our skin, that keep our skin clean. So all of these, you know, the kindness of these tiny little microbes. And so the ratio of what's us and what are other microbes is 8 to 1. One of our cells to 8 microbes. So we're only one eighth of us is us, and the rest isn't even us. All right. So now, how old are you? Then you even think, well, actually, if we go down to below all the cellular things, down onto atoms and molecules. So what are we made up? You know, carbon and H2O and all of these things. So those atoms, those carbon atoms, they're billions of years old. Those atoms that make up all the various chemical compounds in our body are billions of years old. And they've just come together in this configuration as a human body. And we think, that's me. I'm this old. So the answer, so how old are you really? What's the answer? On an ultimate level, yes. That's true. So the answer is there is no really. That's the answer. There is no really. So we have this yearning, but what is it really? Who am I really? There is no really. It depends. And on an ultimate level, how old are you? Ageless. No age. Yeah. On a relative level, well, it depends, and it depends what we're looking at, and the answers are always going to be different. So this kind of wisdom has a big effect on us because, you know, age is a dependent arising. We've got causes and conditions, our birth time, our genetics, our mental age, our physical age. We have the parts of our body, the ratio of time, everything ages at a different rate, the atoms are billions of years old. And then, so all of this, we can't settle on a what, how old am I really? So then we come to the most subtle view, which is imputation. How old am I? Is how old we identify as. Functionally, that's how old we are. So what are we going to identify as? So we think it's a done deal. It's a real solid thing. Oh, there's nothing we can do about it. Well, actually, there's everything that we can do about it. How old we identify as, our state of mind, all of our associations, making the very best of where we find ourselves. So making the best of youth, making the best of middle age, making the best of old age, because we know it's not just that. So this takes me to this wonderful story of what is it? The old people's home for, can't remember what the name. No, it's similar to that, but it's this this study they did in England where they got a bunch of like 70 and 80 year olds and they put them all in a house and they decorated it from the time of their youth, from the 60s. So they had 60s furniture, they had all the 60s records, shag pile, they had all the disgusting food that they ate in the 60s, you know, party pineapples and whatever. And they put them in there for 4 weeks. And so these people walked in there in their walking frames feeling old and crotchety and how they weren't, you know, getting the respect that they should as elders and all that kind of thing. And over the time of just being in the circumstances of their youth, they started, without even noticing, identifying with that. So they put on a record and they start dancing. So they'd start moving. So out goes the walking cane or whatever. And by the end of the 4 weeks, they were actually acting like, say, midlife crisis age, you know, 40-year-olds. but not old anymore. And physiologically, their bodies changed. So their arthritis got less, their whole outlook changed, their amount of energy came up, everything. Just from the conditions changing and the conditions changing what they are identifying as. And that was the singular most important thing, not the physical diseases or the age. That wasn't. So, you know, you take that and it's a glorious experiment and really funny, especially what they said. Think, okay, so it really depends on our mind. That's the key. And you look at someone like our amazing lamas, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you know, who's in his late 80s and only just started looking a little bit aged, you know, for the rest of the time, traveling around the world all the time and no jet lag, so much energy, so much care. So how's this even possible? So how we identify. So there is this tension that happens between what the appearances are but how they exist on all these different levels to an ultimate level. And we have a yearning for absolutes. We want to know, how old am I really? We have this yearning. And so what we kind of tend to do is just fall into the mistake of settling on one thing, I am this or I am that. And then the whole possibilities collapse in. So why this matters? Well, of course, how old we are determines a whole lot of things, like if we can drive or drink or vote. But even then, even just getting a license, you know, you have to be able to, it's not just the age, is it? You've got to, it's the age of your eyes. It's the age of your mind. We identify with our appearance as us. And so if we identify with our physical body as being old, we're going to start feeling that way. Our physical body isn't us. And our mind, well, our mind has no age and has no form and it has no color and has no gender. So all of those things of who we are, not us. And, well, yes, our body is in the nature of change, so it will deteriorate, but luckily our mind can continue to develop. So what we can do is settle on a convention that's in tune with reality and that's positive. So this is how we can take it a step further. This is from Lama Yeshe. Another way of saying this is that when you have a problem, for instance, a thought, this is a good thought or this is a bad thought, remember that, in fact, both types of thought are unified in having clarity as their nature. So, you know, a this or a that, me or you, good or bad, pleasant, unpleasant. Actually, they're unified in having clarity as their nature. For instance, if I pour two glasses of water into one container, even if I shake it up and the water looks disturbed, the nature of the water from both glasses is still clean, clear. Shaking them up together doesn't turn the water into something else like fire. It still retains its clean, clear water energy. Sometimes it looks complicated when we present. Therefore, I want you to understand that according to the Buddhist point of view, there is no human problem that cannot be solved by human beings. Each one of us should understand this personally and encourage yourself by thinking, I can deal with my problems. I can solve my problems. That attitude is essential for your spiritual growth. Even though we may not be much good as meditators or spiritual practitioners, I truly believe that if we have some understanding and encouragement, we can solve all of our problems. And so this is how we can do it. This is how we can actually release that rigidity in our mind by having this kind of questioning that makes all of those things that we think of as absolutes dissolve. And that gives us space. So the question is, when are you celebrating your birthday? I'm sure you can get really creative with that answer. You can go home tonight and go, well, folks, time to bring out the birthday cake. So, you know, we can do this rigorous analysis of what is it really. And what that does is it breaks down our, it's like instinctual grasping for absolutes, for this is the way it is. This grasping and just wanting to hold on to it. And it'll break down this sense of me. And it's the sense of me, the real me, that causes the problems. So Lama Yeshe says, without the wisdom understanding reality, there is no way to cut the root of suffering. We're just constantly trimming the leaves. So it's okay to constantly trim the leaves, but, you know, it's never ending. And we might not have a chance to trim the leaves in a while. So cutting the root of suffering, it's really imperative for us if we want to be happy and peaceful and we want to be able to help others. The other thing about this really rigorous analysis is that when we have a problem or when we have people that we don't like or we disagree with, we can go through this analysis as well and see that there's a lot more going on and it gives us room to move, that they're not all bad. And then the solution will naturally become apparent. Whereas if we just go problem, hate them, there's no way to solve that problem. So this getting used to this analysis in easy things can help us with the others. So then we'll be able to naturally develop confidence. Whatever happens to us, we won't lose our confidence. We'll be resilient as a natural result. We'll also be able to naturally care for others, whether we like them or not, whether we know them or not, whether they're our family or whether they're somebody else's family, because we'll understand, we'll be underpinned by this understanding. And long term, we'll be able to eliminate suffering. So that's the big picture. We'll be able to open up to our vast potential. So we can only do that if we can actually see a possibility of change. And if we can get to that, well, what is the essence of me? None of those things that make me separate from others. It's actually the things that unify us with others. Awareness, feelings, worth. So the bumper sticker, things do not exist in the way they first appear. And so during the week, there's a self-reflection sheet in the booklets that Delma had next door. There's a wisdom worksheet and there's the meditation, who am I really, to go through. Or you can just do the really simple version. Lama Yeshe said, keep asking, how am I at this moment interpreting myself? Am I interpreting myself as old or young, as smart or stupid, as capable, as incapable? Like, how am I interpreting myself? And recognize it for what it is, an interpretation. Even if we feel like it's true, that's just a feeling. It's not the truth. So we can dedicate the merits. Next week, we're going to have a look at renunciation. So what renunciation means, how to not sweat the small stuff, how to not get overwhelmed by the small stuff. And then the things that do go well, how to really enjoy them. So let's dedicate the merits, shall we? Take a nice deep breath and let everything settle into your mind. Feel that everything that we've talked about, all the words are like drops of light, like a beautiful summer rainfall. These drops of light absorbing into you, absorbing into your mind, that you can come back to at your leisure, that you can develop as realizations. Feel that they become part of you. Remember your motivation from the beginning of this class. The immediate things that you hoped Buddhism would help about, and dedicate your efforts to being able to, you know, bring solutions to those. but also dedicate for long-term lasting peace and happiness for oneself, for everyone that you're responsible for, and for all living beings. Because in essence, they're no different from us. They might appear different, but fundamentally, they're no different from us. Fundamentally, they're just like us in wanting happiness and no suffering. And fundamentally, we're connected with everybody. So dedicate, may our good-heartedness and all of our efforts spread peace and happiness to everybody, eventually to the entire world.